Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
So welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. Today we have a guest, Rob Cross, who is the VP of PSC. Rob and his company work in big data analytics. So this is an interesting one. I've had so many students want to talk about where the next generation of big data is going. What happens to all this big data? And Rob has some great insight on that. Rob, welcome today, and thanks for joining.
Great. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
Right. So Rob, we were talking a little bit before the show, and I'm really interested to find out your take on data and software and where it's going. Give me a minute, quick explanation of what your business does.
Oh, sure. Thanks for the opportunity. Our company, we perform independent assessments currently on software, analyzing it forensically using our platform technology, looking for security risks in the application layer. We do have clients that ask us to look at quality, testability, all the different abilities of software. And it's a managed service offering, so people provide us access to their software, and we go through it using lots of different technology, which we can talk about later if there's an opportunity. And then turn all that information, that big data footprint that we generate, into actionable results. So it's a very turnkey service, and we inject that back into our client's development environment or corporation to give them visibility as to where they have risks, and they can consequently do a quick turn and get immediate return on investment and secure their assets for their customer-facing systems or internal systems.
Yeah, I wanted to kind of put that out there to kind of show what type of things you do and how you know what your expertise in this area is. But Rob, give us your background. Tell us how you got to where you're at in your life, something personal about you. What's your story?
I'm a Midwestern kid. I grew up in Ohio, and I met my current business partners working for a startup in Boston. We were selling some software development technology that was a development information system, and for Y2K way back in the day. I'm sure that dates me a little bit. we had a great rapport, and Pro Services at the time was just strictly a consulting company. And they wanted to relaunch the company in more of a managed service offering by providing this turnkey service. And so they courted me to come over as a partner. And back in 2000, that's when I made the jump and really relaunched Pro Services. And since then, it's been a wild ride, and it's been fun. We've analyzed over 8 billion lines of code since we started off in this direction, which is a lot of software. So That's my background. I always like to say I'm the mouthpiece of my company, but I'm a technical software guy by osmosis, not by education. But I usually can hold my own in a room with engineers because I've been doing it for so long.
Yeah, interesting background. So we were talking before about just the growth of software. You just said you have analyzed a billion lines of code, and your take is that this. You know, we have software everywhere and everything we touch, everything we use, and it's exploding beyond and out of control.
Yeah, absolutely. You just look at automobiles, and you know they're projecting that automobiles currently have more lines of code in them than jet fighters, which we all always associate as next gen technology. And with the explosion of the IoT, the Internet of Things space, everything in your house is networked. I think the statistics now are that every person has at least 3 connected devices, and that's going to grow to 15 over the next 10 years. I might be, don't quote me exactly on that, but I believe that's somewhere in the range. And what the scary part is that, yes, software, everything's controlled by software, and the internet things are connecting everything to the network. And what I find fascinating, and I was going to write a blog about this, is, you know, can your family room get you sued, jokingly enough? That if you remember back, I think it was back in October, or the DIN Corporation that manages all the DNSs of, you know, Uber and all these big brands, and they had a denial of service attack that took down all these big websites. And the do you remember that, or does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, I've heard about that.
Okay, so the watershed moment there was that was done through the Mirai virus that went out and recruited all these IoT devices and amassed a massive denial of service attack. And what they're finding out is that, you know, people who buy these IoT devices and put in their home, whether it's their router or your Ring doorbell or whatever, they come with the default username of admin and default password of password. And a lot of home routers are that way too, are that way as well. So it doesn't take much to recruit these things as zombie bots, and all of a sudden amass this massive attack. And I jokingly say that, you know, you're sitting in your family room watching TV through your network TV and your home router, and yet all those devices are participating in a massive denial of service attack somewhere in the world, and you don't even know it. And you know, you're going to get a letter someday saying, hey, your IP address was a contributor to this attack, and, you know, we're going to sue you because you didn't protect things. I don't know if it'll get to that level, but it's an interesting way to explore. So I think as software starts to permutate its way into our lives in a massive way in scales we don't even realize, you know, everybody walks around with a supercomputer with their iPhones or their Android devices in their pockets that are, you know, an order of magnitude more powerful than the ENIAC way back when with the U.S. Army and their first computer, mm-hmm. Doing infantry or artillery charts, it really does start to, I don't want to say infect your life, but really provides a huge attack surface for hackers to take advantage of that growing capability.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break real quick here for our sponsor break, and we'll be right back talking to Rob about where these dangers lie.
Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
All right, so welcome back, and we're here with Rob Cross, the VP of PSC, talking about software and the growth of just the amount out there and what kind of dangers we might need to look at. So, Rob, we were talking about how that there's just so much software out there, and the typical car has more lines of code now than a jet fighter. And I imagine because they use all kinds of off-the-shelf products that have all kinds of things you don't need in there, where a jet fighter would use just a specific design for that jet fighter. That's kind of why there's so much more code in a car?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, a lot of the technology they're infusing on these automobile platforms actually come from the military with all their sensor technologies. But yeah, I mean, they're bolting on capabilities onto cars that are software intensive. I mean, just think about I think that Mercedes commercial. How, you know, if you're starting to fall asleep, it vibrates your chair. I mean, that's all through sensors. It's the forward collision. It's the airbags. It's GPS. It's, you know, all these systems are software intensive. And I think the automobile industry. And then we haven't even gotten into autonomous driving, which to me, I think they need to put the brakes on that, and we can get that just in a minute. But I think somewhat the problem that the auto industry has is the same problem that the military has, is when you go out and you procure from your supply chain certain functionality or capabilities to put on that vehicle or whatever that platform is, there's software in it. And how are you holding that supply chain accountable to make sure that that has been properly vetted through internal process, securing your supply chain? And that's been, you know, been increasingly noisy in the market over the past 2 or 3 years of securing your supply chain, because let's face it, when you know the infamous hack of someone pulling over a Jeep while it's driving, which we all read about, these researchers, right? Now that I think they work for Uber. Great, that's a great way to get a job. Hack into a car. You know, when Jeep got that press headline, no one cares that they hacked into the radio. They hacked into the radio component, which was made by said supplier. No one cares about that. What they see is Jeep. What they see is Fiat Chrysler. And the brand equity of Fiat Chrysler takes a huge hit. And, you know, I can only imagine that a marketing person somewhere in Fiat Chrysler or Jeep was grinding their teeth that day saying, I just spent $20 million on Super Bowl commercials and everything else to elevate the brand, and all it took was these two researchers who hacked into our vehicle, and now all of a sudden our sales are dipping over the next 2 months. I mean, that's the escalation of how software is such an integral part of the things that we didn't necessarily think of 10 years ago.
Yeah,
That's why I think I really need to go out and buy a 69 Camaro, because there's no software in that.
Yeah. So explain this supply chain problem. I don't think I've had anybody talk about, you know, what that means. I mean, obviously, people hear supply chain, they think of, you know, their vegetables that they get from the grocery store, the products that they're using in the company. But we're talking supply chain here for software. Explain that in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, no problem. I think at a just a fundamental level, there is software you develop organically through your employees, and then there is software that you pull from either vendors or the open source community to bolt in and add additional functionality. And the open source and the vendors that are providing you capabilities to your end product that are software intensive would be your supply chain. And where we've often found our clients struggle is that we've been pulled into a lot of situations where sometimes we walk into organizations and they don't necessarily hold themselves to a great standard, but they hold their supply chain to a higher standard, or there's no standard at all. So it kind of varies back and forth. But essentially what we try to work with teams, or try to advise your audience listening, is that all those things that are developed outside your organization that is of unknown provenance, which is, you know, you haven't characterized what those risks are, you better know. Because once you put those into your end products, it is your brand. And when something goes wrong, you can't necessarily point to your supply chain, because your consumer doesn't care. You're selling the product, you own that responsibility. So if you're pulling in something from the open source community, which is, you know, really, really prevalent because of the economics of it, you better scan it to make sure, better make sure it's all up to date and contribute back to that community to make sure that product is safe and secure and performs to your standards, as well as your vendors. And the vendor side of, like I mentioned, with your let's say your automobile manufacturer, and you're pulling in a radio, and that's very software intensive. How are you vetting the software in that radio to make sure it's protected for not only quality targets, but also security targets? And that gets to be a little bit tricky, because when you get down to the code level, many manufacturers basically say, hey, listen, Mr. Supplier, we trust that you're following best practices and that you're signing up that this is good. Well, those days aren't good enough. Those days are gone. That's not good enough anymore. And what mm-hmm. we're finding corporations doing is they're putting in play an independent center of excellence that when these vendors are coming up with major releases to be integrated into the end product by the manufacturer, it goes through this independent COE, Center of Excellence, because one, you know, we don't have a competing interest. We don't build radios or a company like ours. We can protect their IP, and we're very objective. So we're not really caught up in the politics of the data. We're after the truth and the accuracy of the information to make sure that when the supplier gives the end product, it's all been tied out, all been buttoned down, locked down, and that high-level data is delivered with the product to the manufacturer saying, hey, this has made it through the COE, all these things have been vetted, everything's locked down per specs, and then it can be integrated. And that's really taking care of the downstream, so you're, as the manufacturer, protecting your brand as best as you can at the software layer, which, like I said, is increasing exponentially year over year.
So
I don't know if that clarifies it.
Yeah, as far as A typical product like a car or a Jeep or whatever, since we talked about Jeep, how many different vendors, different subcontractors, supply chain people create software? Just give me an estimate that goes into that one product.
Gosh, they're a lot. I don't know if I could put a number on it. In our experience on some programs, that can be in upwards of 50.
So 50 different software vendors. And how many people, how many actual coders do you think contribute to that overall pool?
You know, we're never privy to that number. To us, it doesn't necessarily, that's not the substantial number that we look for, but I would say it's hundreds.
Okay.
You look at some of the bigger vendors like Harman Kardon and, Panasonic, some of the guys who do the entertainment systems.
Uh-huh.
And they have hundreds of software engineers pumping out software.
At each company. And if we're talking an open source product, it could be thousands of people contributed to that.
Absolutely. Christopher, just think of this. I had the privilege of attending a conference where Citi came with their, I believe it was Citi, and they came with their cyber unit, and they were briefing us on what they do, best practices. And just as another example of software is eating the world, Citi as an organization, they don't consider themselves a business financial institution, business service, being a business financial services. They consider themselves a tech company. They have more software engineers than Microsoft. So they view the culture of their company has shifted so much that they view themselves as a tech company that, oh, by the way, just happens to have a license to do financial services.
Wow,
like
that's interesting. Let me take a break real quick here for a sponsor break, and we'll come right back onto that conversation.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
So we were talking before the break how some of even the world's largest corporations that do, say, banking now have more software developers than they do banking industry people and consider themselves a software services or development company. That was an interesting comment. And you mentioned Citi was like that. What does that do for the marketplace, for that type of a company? Do they start then selling that software, or is it all internal?
No, I think they sell their software to their customers, whether it's, businesses, small businesses. I mean, they produce products. And Fidelity is another great example. I haven't worked with Fidelity directly, but I do have some colleagues of mine who have, and they have a really great culture where they also consider themselves a technology company. And I've heard that they basically have groups. It's very entrepreneurial, and they have groups that spin up almost like a startups within a big corporation that compete against each other to spin out products to their clients, and which I find fascinating. That's what every big company wants, is how do you get that Silicon Valley startup entrepreneurial spirit inside a big conglomerate or big financial services company. But yeah, they certainly develop technology for themselves, and some of their trading platforms and whatnot, and their internal folks, but then obviously for their clients. But I found that fascinating, that I did not view them as such. And when they gave me that statistic, my jaw dropped, and I was like, and that's a huge cultural change for them. It's taken them years, but they're there. They consider themselves a tech company.
Interesting. So now your take. We had talked before that there's some dangers in here, just the sheer amount of software, the uncontrollable nature of it. the unknown supply chain, the thousands and thousands of people to develop code for any given product. Who is that a concern for, and what are the concerns?
Well, I think at multiple levels, it should be a concern for consumers. I can tell you from, I think I have a, my company has a unique perspective because we've looked at billions of lines of code, but you know, this whole autonomous driving craze that the industry, and I know we're picking on the automobile industry today, and I don't mean to, but the autonomous vehicle initiative that people are charging after, it's amazing to me that there is very little government regulation. And I'm not a big government regulation person, but I think when it comes to safety and consumer-facing products, I absolutely believe that there should be. And I can tell you that when we analyze software on safety-critical systems, whether it's, you know, aviation or fire control or other, you know, safety-critical devices, medical devices, right, where if something goes wrong, loss of life could be a likely consequence,
mm-hmm.
There's government regulation. I mean, the FDA monitors software and medical devices. The FAA monitors software on aircraft to a very strict standard, the D0178B standard. When you look at autonomous vehicles, what's scary is that the automobile industry is ahead of the government. And I get a little bit nervous with that they're coding millions and millions and millions and millions of lines of code that with humans, not, I'm sure some of it's generated, that has errors in it. And I can tell you that I'm sure they're fraught with errors. And how is that being independently vetted and certified, saying, yep, we're going to take this, you know, 6,000-pound vehicle and drive it at 55 miles an hour, or, you know, the danger zone, which is under 40 miles an hour, where there's a lot of different independent variables that can cause, you know, vehicles to get in crashes, and certify that it's good to put on autopilot, and there's no government oversight that says, yeah, this release has been put through all these tests and has been verified, and now you can turn that on. I mean, that's a little scary, and I think that's and the fact that the industry is ahead of the government, and that I don't trust it, and yet I don't see anyone putting the brakes on. In fact, everyone is getting on this bandwagon and saying, let's go faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Uber, I think the other week, Uber's vehicles, I think it was in Pittsburgh or somewhere, got in an accident, so they, you know, had to pause the program. And I just don't want it to be one of these things where people have to die in order to get Congress and the government to say, hey, wait a second, maybe we're moving too fast, we take a step back. I know that the consumer wants to get to autonomous, the car companies do, and that's the shiny new coin, everyone getting to autonomous driving. But maybe we just need to take a couple steps back to make sure that when we get there the right way, and consumers don't have to pay the price with their lives and beating these things into existence. Because you can't treat it like a Windows update where you push out an update because we found a zero-day bug. I mean, a zero-day bug on autonomous driving could result in loss of life.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that the automobile companies are treating it that lightly, but at the same time, I don't really read anything about the government really coming in a hard way saying, hey guys, we need to slow down here to make sure that we're protecting the consumer, which I think is one of the government's primary roles.
Yeah. So now the autonomous car, and yeah, we're beating up on this industry today, but literally 10 years ago, I had a good friend who designed a lot of the systems on board some cars. And basically at that point, literally the brake when you were pushing it, the gas pedal, the cruise control, all those functions in the car were computer controlled. So the user, the driver, wasn't actually physically operating the car anymore. They were accessing controls to a computer, which then in turn operated the car. So it's almost like that's been happening for a while now in the auto industry. The question here is connecting them up to the rest of the world and the security of that interface.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I almost envision a day where the car is almost like an iPhone. It's just a platform, and it's really software driven, and what you load onto is up to you. And yeah, I mean, your transmission, I mean, you know, my wife just, you know, we bought a new car last year, and you don't shift anything mechanically. You hit a button to go from park to drive. And I didn't want to buy the car because of that, because I still like to shift it down and get a mechanically engaged, you know, transmission click. But You know, it's, I think it just exposes it to more issues that are software related. And that is a bit scary. I'm not sure. I mean, that's just the direction. I don't think you can stop that direction. And you know, for the most part, I will give these guys, you know, some really great credit. For the guys that developed the transmissions and the engine control modules and the safety related stuff on cars, I mean, they dial their stuff in pretty tight. Most of the software we've looked on that side, because they're dealing with finite resources, they're pretty dialed in tight. It's on the other things like the entertainment systems and some of the apps that run on the cars and whatnot. That's where in the autonomous side, that's why I get a little bit nervous with where that's not under the same scrutiny.
Okay, yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot of danger there for the consumer. So now if I'm a business owner and I'm looking to say, what do I need to address here? What do I start looking at?
Well, I think if you're a business owner and if you're developing software either for yourself or that goes into a product, yeah, I think you just need to take a step back and first look at your processes or your process, and how have you incorporated security into the fundamental operations of how you do business. And so much of our clientele, it's security used to be somewhat of an afterthought. It's getting more and more in the forefront of their mind that, hey, have we done all the security checks? Now that's, you know, that's starting to elevate into the boardroom where cybersecurity is a regular part of the dialogue. But I think you say take a step back and say, where is security as a part of our software development lifecycle, and at what point? Is it late in the process? Is it early in the process? All the smart money would say you need to be earlier in the process. And then what type of questions, and this is where we get more of the big data analytics, is what questions do you want answered from a software perspective? You know, And based on that, that drives into the early part of the process of what type of data you need to generate. Mm-hmm. You know, are you developing SQL injection commands? Is this touch the network? Where does it touch the network? Are ports left open, not left open? You know, all that stuff are questions you need to answer about how secure is your end product when you're going to release it. And from that, once you understand those questions, you can start pulling in technology that can start to populate a more robust data model.
Yeah.
And that's where you get to do the rendered intelligence, and then that gets, you know, pushed back to engineers to start to mitigate. And then you start to get in that proactive cycle. But I think it's when you look across as a business owner, the first thing to do is to look at all the products you develop and start ranking them in priority of which ones have customer facing, internal, which ones are touching the network, and you start to prioritize, and then from there, to what level of scrutiny that drives what scrutiny that they should come under from a security standpoint, and then just making sure that your process is, you know, measurable and repeatable, so when you get that information, you know it's been done the same way across the board, so you kind of normalize everything. So as an executive, when you look across your portfolio of things that you produce that are software, you can get a good risk rating of, you know, which ones are trending in the right way. And it's all based on the same process, the same baseline information, and you can first measure it and then start to manage it and mitigate it. And I think those are real key components.
Okay. So now from your experience, lots of companies you've worked with, what are the common top five areas or so that you address almost every time or more often than not? Give our listeners the first five steps that you give most customers after you do analysis.
Well, yeah, after we do an analysis, this is really getting into our business. The great thing about our analysis is that you can always reverse engineer forensically what might be going wrong in the process. And the biggest culprit we find, and it's unavoidable, is products are shipped to a date. No matter what people say, you know, our process says we need to get this thing out the door in 6 months, or our process says it's going to take 6 months to develop this, and guess what, you get 6 weeks, or you know, 3 months instead of 6 months. Once the decision of speed is the objective has been made, and it happens every day across the world, and it's not necessarily the wrong decision, the most development shops we work with use technology to help them identify risks. The problem is when you're asking an engineer to do more with less time, they ignore that great information. And part and parcel because they don't have enough time to look at the data. And secondly, the data itself is fairly large and there's a lot of false positive information in it. So it's kind of like the needle in the haystack. So what we try to advise them on is that you have to first recognize that you do this to yourself. And usually everyone says, yes, we understand that we shift to a date and we lose visibility into risk. The second thing we recommend is what, from our analysis, count what's the saying? What counts is counted. That's what it is. What counts is counted. What matters to you? And so even though you can identify thousands of different things in software that are security risks, for an organization that hasn't really gone through this the first time, you know, pick the top 25, pick the top 50, and let's just start there of things that you start to incorporate into a standard of things that are absolute, you shall not have these in the software at any point in time. You got to hold the line somewhere. And the third thing we tell people to do is you need to have an educational element in your organization. This is a cultural movement. Security, it shouldn't be one of these things that we do. It should be who we are. And that's a huge transition culturally, where we walk into a lot of shops that they're almost embarrassed to expose security vulnerabilities or, geez, I created that. And transitioning that culturally over to, yeah, I created to it, I own it, I'm not embarrassed by it, people are helping me out with it, and I'm sharing that knowledge across the workspace is a cultural transformation that takes executive leadership and comes through training. What's important to us about security? How do you inject that knowledge into the workforce? And how do you hold people accountable? And how do they hold each other accountable to that standard through a process for consistent measurement? So once you get that in place, you start migrating what the standards are that you want to hold yourself accountable to. Then you start working on what are the technology pieces that will help you out better in getting better reliable data. And unfortunately, in our industry, in the software industry, when people start to attack security, they tend to start with the technology piece first. Mm-hmm. It's, hey, let's go out and get a tool. Let's go out and buy this. Let's go out and get this widget. Let's go download this. And, you know, engineers, developers love to do that. They like to go get an open source tool and run over some code and say, hey, I got this. And that's actually, I think, we believe the wrong place to go. Instead, you need to do those, you know, the focus on the people, the training, the process, the standards, and the last piece really is the technology side of things. And what technology can you go out and acquire, or if you want to do an open source configuration, that can start producing reliable information. And that's really where we come in, because our company, because we use anywhere from 10 to 20 different technologies, when we do an assessment, our platform renders that down and eliminates redundant findings and does machine learning to prioritize things to try to take, you know, 100,000 things that are potential issues and narrow it down to 300. And so how do you start putting into play an integrated framework so you can use more technology, the right technology, but give you more powerful, actionable items at the end without having burdening your engineers with the mountain of data for them to go through manually? And then the last piece is, how do you take that entire process and make sure that it's owned at the very front? And so engineers and managers are capturing this critical information of how this system's evolving at the point of where it's being created, versus when we typically first get involved with clients that admit they ship to a date, they're in a reactive mode. So how do we shift that to proactive cultural evolution based off measurement standards, technology, process? And that's not a light switch. So sometimes it's really easy for us to come in and say, yeah, you know, you've got problems. I mean, that's not really being helpful to a certain degree. But coming in saying, you've got problems, good news is you're in good company, you're no different than everyone else, but how do we start putting on you a path to healing over the next 6 months, 2 years, sometimes 3 years if it's a big organization, to start getting that cultural transformation so security isn't what we do, it's who we are. And that's just a real important shift. And everyone's got to be on board from executive to engineers, because you're providing that transparency of information between those levels. And that's what's actually the exciting part about seeing that transformation, is when executives have the same understanding of risk that engineers do and the two no longer talk past each other, that's where you really start to cook with oil, as I like to say. That's a fun thing to see, because oftentimes those two audiences talk past one another, because executives tend to manage projects as cost, schedule, performance, and engineers tend to manage their risks by null pointers, SQL injections, default switches, which is total geek oil and Greek to any executive and hurts their ears.
Yeah.
So when you get those two, you know, working from the same sheet of music, it's really great.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear that. It's good to hear that focus on the overall business management and organizational processes as really where we need to focus, because I agree with that entirely. But kind of in wrapping up here, if somebody did want to engage you, how would they reach out and get a hold of you?
Well, that's great. Well, they can go to our website, which is proservicescorp.com. They can connect with me on LinkedIn. You can find me under Robert Cross, C-R-O-S-S. They can email me. My email address is rob.cross@proservicescorp.com.
Get a hold of Rob at his website is probably the best way, and he did give his email there as well. But thanks for joining today, Rob. It's definitely been interesting, and we're always looking for new topics and exciting things to discuss, and software is definitely, and the security of software is definitely something we haven't talked about too much in the past. So thanks for joining today, Rob, and you have a great day.
Thank you for the opportunity. Glad to be part of it.
The views or opinions expressed by me during this podcast are my own and are not those of my employer, Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.